Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for today, Friday, July 24th, 2020. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. Top headline today is PMR properties to pay more than $40,000 for lead-based paint violations. PMR Properties LLC, a property management company that has housing units in Council Bluffs and elsewhere in Iowa, has agreed to pay the Environmental Protection Agency a $40,800 civil penalty. Well, I think it's $40,800. They add an extra zero, so it's either $40,800 or $408,000. I'm not sure. But I believe it's $40,800 because of where the comma is, and then they just accidentally add an extra zero on the end. But I'll just to note that. They agreed to pay that civil penalty after the company failed to notify tenants and potential tenants of lead-based paint hazards at its properties. The EPA reached a settlement with PMR, which manages about 400 housing units in Iowa, Nebraska, and Missouri, regarding alleged violations of lead-based paint regulations under the Federal Toxic Substances Control Act earlier this month, the agency said. Notification of potential and actual lead hazards by landlords to tenants is one of the easiest and most cost-effective ways to avoid dangerous lead exposure, EPA Region 7 Administrator Jim Gilfoyd said in a release. Tenants must have the ability to make informed decisions, especially when it comes to protecting their children. The settlement was filed on July 14th. The EPA said PMR has 30 days after the, after the settlement date to pay the penalty. The company had not paid as of Wednesday. The EPA said during an investigation, it found that the property management company repeatedly failed to distribute required lead hazard information pamphlets to tenants in pre-1978 housing. EPA also alleged that PMR Properties received information from the Iowa Department of Public Health that state inspections of certain properties demonstrated positive test results for lead, and that PMR Properties failed to notify tenants of those known lead hazards or provide the reports before they were obligated under contract to lease the units. Answering follow-up questions to the announcement, the EPA told the Nonpareil the Iowa Department of Public Health inspections occurred on July 6, 2012 and February 20, 2013, with the results mailed to PMR on July 13, 2012 and February 25, 2013, respectively. The settlement also required PMR to begin notifying tenants about hazards. The EPA said by signing the consent agreement in final order, PMR certified that it is now in compliance with the requirements of the Toxic Substances Control Act. The EPA may use its statutory authorities to gather information about ongoing compliance if warranted. The agency said it was unable to disclose specific properties or addresses that had lead-based paint hazards. An employee with the Council Bluffs PMR office said the property management company distributes a pamphlet on lead-based paint. The employee said she had no knowledge of lead-based paint hazards in Council Bluffs properties. The employee directed any further questions to a manager who did not immediately return multiple messages. The EPA said lead-contaminated dust from chipped or peeling lead-based paint in homes built prior to 1978 is one of the most common causes of elevated blood levels in children. Infants and children are especially vulnerable to lead paint exposure because their growing bodies absorb more lead than adults do, and their brains and nervous systems are more sensitive to the damaging effects of lead. The agency continued, saying children can be exposed from multiple sources and may experience irreversible and lifelong health effects. Lead dust can be generated when lead-based paint deteriorates or is disturbed. The EPA said about 3.6 million American households have children under 6 years of age who live in homes with lead exposure hazards. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about 500,000 American children between ages 1 and 5 have blood lead levels at or above the CDC blood lead reference value, the level at which CDC recommends public health actions begin. According to the CDC, no safe blood lead level has been identified. Farmers Market vouchers still available. Farmers Market vouchers are still available for older Iowans in the Connections Area Agency on Aging Service Area, the agency announced this week. Remaining vouchers will be distributed on a first-call, first-served basis. Qualifying seniors can obtain vouchers for $30 worth of fresh, locally grown produce offered at participating area farmers markets, a press release from Connections stated. To be eligible, applicants must be at least 60 years old and have annual income of less than $23,606 for single adults or $31,894 for married couples. Only one original application is allowed per person. Married couples can apply jointly on one application. Those interested in an application should call Connections at 1-800-432-9209, since area senior centers are closed. Forms will be mailed out with a postage paid returned envelope. All information must be provided before vouchers will be mailed out. Half of Iowa casinos requiring face masks. Harrah's and Horseshoe Casinos and Council Bluffs included. More than half of Iowa's 23 casinos are requiring guests to wear face masks while inside the casino. According to an analysis of the casino's coronavirus-related policies posted on their websites, 12 casinos are now requiring all guests wear face masks inside the casinos. Some of the requirements say the mask mandate is in effect whenever guests are within 6 feet of each other. Another 11 casinos are not requiring face masks, but say they are encouraging or recommending guests wear them. Some casinos are providing masks to guests who do not arrive with them. Public health and infectious disease experts, as well as some early studies, say wearing face masks helps prevent the spread of the new coronavirus and COVID-19, the disease the virus causes. As of Wednesday afternoon, nearly 40,000 Iowans had contracted the coronavirus at some point during the global pandemic, and 808 Iowans had died of COVID-19. Those kinds of efforts and initiatives are evolving constantly and should be, said Wes Ericke, president and CEO of the Iowa Gaming Association, which represents 19 casinos across the state. I believe we're trying to provide that entertainment experience in as accommodating but also responsible a fashion as possible. The casinos that are requiring guests wear face masks, according to their policies posted online, are Grand Falls Casino and Golf Resort in Larchwood, Harrah's and Horseshoe Casinos in Council Bluffs, Isle Casino Hotels in Bettendorf and Waterloo, Prairie Flower Casino in Carter Lake, Prairie Meadows in Altoona, Rhythm City Casino Resort in Davenport, Riverside Casino and Golf Resort in Riverside, Meskwaki Bingo Casino in Tama, Blackbird Bend Casino in Onawa, and Winnevegas Casino Resort in Sloan. The casinos that are not requiring masks but are encouraging or recommending that guests wear them are Ameristar Casino Hotel in Council Bluffs, Casino Queen in Marquette, Catfish Bend Casino in Burlington, Diamond Joe Casinos in Dubuque and Northwood, Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Sioux City, Lakeside Hotel Casino in Osceola, Q Casino in Dubuque, and the Wild Rose Casinos in Clinton, Emmitsburg, and Jefferson. Each casino also has other virus-related policies and practices. Most are requiring workers to wear masks, and many are employing other social distancing measures and frequently sanitizing gaming areas. I think the overriding thing here is that every casino has put in extensive protocols and procedures for the safety of their patrons and of their staff, Ericke said. Four casinos, Blackbird Bend, Winnevegas, Meskwaki, and Prairie Flower, have also taken the extra step of banning smoking, according to the American Lung Association. Those four casinos are not governed by state regulations. State-regulated casinos are exempt from the state's smoke-free law. We applaud the decision of the owners of these four casinos for adopting a smoke-free workplace policy as they reopen after COVID-19 forced businesses to shut their doors, American Lung Association Advocacy Director Christina Hamilton said in a news release. This policy will protect the health of workers and customers from dangerous secondhand smoke and e-cigarette emissions, and we call for the permanent adoption of this policy. USDA study shows gulf between cattle processed beef prices. A study released Wednesday by the U.S. Agriculture Department into the disparity between cattle prices paid to ranchers and the higher prices earned by meat processors offers more details about the factors that have led to this situation. The 20-page analysis by the USDA explains how, after a 2019 fire at a Tyson Foods beef plant in Holcomb, Kansas, and this year's temporary closure of slaughterhouses amid the coronavirus pandemic, ranchers saw cattle prices drop while concerns about meat scarcity caused prices at grocery stores to rise. Some members of Congress have called for an investigation into possible violations of the Packers and Stockyard Act, which is designed to protect ranchers and consumers. They have noted increasing consolidation within the beef industry, which is now largely controlled by four giant processing companies. The study specified that it wasn't an examination of potential violations of the Packers and Stockyard Act, but that an investigation was ongoing. South Dakota Senator John Thune, who is among those seeking an investigation, said he would continue pushing for the Department of Justice to finish its investigation of possible market manipulation. South Dakota's cattle producers are facing extreme volatility in the cattle market, and I remain concerned about potential anti-competitive activity in the highly concentrated meatpacking industry, Thune said in a statement. Nebraska Senator Deb Fisher, whose family owns a ranch, also has sought an investigation. The report confirms our serious misgivings about the many factors that are working to destabilize the marketplace, Fisher said. In light of these events and this report, I will be introducing legislation soon in the Senate aimed at providing equity and transparency for all market participants. The study details how both the Kansas fire and the coronavirus caused backups in the processing industry, which in turn caused demand for cattle to drop and prices to decline. At the same time, consumer demand continued and even increased amid supply concerns when the coronavirus led to an emptying of grocery shelves. Although the study focused on documenting the price disparities, it also finds that the situation could benefit from more clearly disseminating market conditions and reinvigorating competition. 6 COVID-19 deaths reported at Risen Sun. State launches mask awareness campaign. There have been 6 deaths tied to a COVID-19 outbreak at Risen Sun Christian Village in Council Bluffs. The state COVID-19 website listed the 17th death in Pottawatomie County late Wednesday. Pottawatomie County Public Health said it was a woman 81 years old or older who lived at Risen Sun. The department also said a death originally not attributed to the Risen Sun is among the 6. A man 81 or older died at a local hospital earlier this month, according to Matt Wyant with Pottawatomie County Public Health. Wyant said Thursday it wasn't initially noted that the man was a Risen Sun resident. The state COVID-19 website, coronavirus.iowa.gov, listed 18 deaths on Thursday afternoon. Wyant said he believed it was a possible duplicate and mistake on the state's part, as there had been no new deaths reported to him. One possibility, he said, is it was reported from out of state directly to the Iowa Department of Public Health and hadn't been reported to the Pottawatomie County Department yet. Asked about discrepancies in the past, the Iowa Department of Public Health has noted numbers are updated frequently to reflect additional information that we might receive through the investigation process. A message to a department official Thursday wasn't immediately returned. Ray Dickison, Chief Operating Officer and leader of a COVID-19 task force for Risen Sun parent company, Christian Horizons, said Thursday that a total of 21 residents in the facility's skilled nursing unit have tested positive. He said several have recovered, with the facility expecting to issue a further update Friday on recoveries. Dickson said 15 staff members at Risen Sun have tested positive, with 6 recovered. Risen Sun said Monday positive staff members are unable to return to work until negative tests have been confirmed in coordination with the local health department's guidance. One of the deaths at Risen Sun was Katie G. Jacobs, age 96, who passed away Wednesday from the coronavirus, according to the family's obituary in the Nonpareil. She loved her farm and kept mowing until the age of 89. She acquired shingles, which began her battle. She fought hard and battled the coronavirus, but ultimately her body and soul wore out, the obituary reads. Around 3:30 p.m. on Thursday, the state COVID-19 website listed 974 positive cases in the county, up 29 from a little over 24 hours earlier. There have been 12,837 tests in the county, and the positive rate increased slightly to 7.6%, the highest in around a month, after weeks in the 7.4 to 7.5% range. The state listed 722 recoveries in the county. Over the slightly more than 24-hour time period, the state reported 841 new cases, putting the total in Iowa at 40,634. There have been 437,848 tests, for a positive rate of 9.3%. There have been recoveries of 28,924, up from 28,607 on Wednesday, and there were 10 new deaths, with the total now at 818. The Iowa Department of Public Health has launched a campaign asking Iowans to wear a mask to stop the spread of COVID-19. The campaign asks the public to Step Up, Mask Up, Iowa. This new outreach campaign encourages Iowans to follow important public health mitigation measures, such as wearing a cloth face covering when in public, the Iowa Department of Public Health said. COVID-19 is far from over, and I don't want to go backwards, Governor Kim Reynolds told Iowans in a recent video address and tweet. Whether it's wearing a mask, social distancing, practicing good hygiene, or staying home when we're sick, these simple steps continue to be the best defense against the virus. So let's step up, Iowa. Protecting yourself means you're protecting your friends, your family members, your coworkers, and your fellow Iowans. Each and every one of us has it in our power to slow the spread of COVID-19. Reynolds has been reticent to issue a statewide mask requirement. Iowa has been one of the only states that does not have any enforceable local or state mask mandates. The Associated Press reported the Republican governor has said that she believes residents will wear them on their own and that municipalities can require them only if she grants that authority, which she's declined to do. Because Reynolds has a public health proclamation in effect, a local official can't implement requirements that conflict with the state rules, the governor said. If it's not consistent with that, then it's not appropriate and it's not in effect, Reynolds said of a mask requirement issued by the mayor of Muscatine. Iowa City has since issued a mask mandate as well. Across the river in Omaha, Douglas County health officials are taking steps towards requiring people to wear masks in indoor public spaces. We're in an unprecedented pandemic now, and we need to do everything we can to slow it down, said Chris Rogers, president of the Douglas County, Nebraska Board of Health. Rogers said county health and legal officials began investigating their options this week after the Lincoln Lancaster County Health Department announced its indoor mask mandate on Friday. For more information on cloth face coverings, including how to make them, how to wear them appropriately, and how to care for them, as well as outreach materials, including Step Up Mask Up Iowa resources, go to idph.iowa.gov/emerging-health-health-issues/novel-coronavirus/public. Now our face of the day, Jeff Snow is up and ready to run on this fine morning. Are you? Snow was born and raised in Neosha, Missouri, a small town on the Missouri-Arkansas border that is also mere miles away from the Kansas and Oklahoma borders. He graduated from Neosho High School in 1998 and later attended Pittsburgh State University in Kansas, where he earned his bachelor's and master's degree in education, graduating around 2005. Snow played football in high school, and a group of his teammates also took part in the school's co-ed cheerleading program. He said his family wasn't in the position to pay for his college, and he was looking for ways to foot the bill. He said he was too undersized to make it playing Division I or II football on scholarship, but when applying for college, he noticed there were several scholarships available for cheerleading. That was his ticket to higher learning. This launched a 15-plus year career in coaching cheerleading and gymnastics, in which he coached or ran businesses for club and high school programs in the Midwest, South, and West Coast. He later moved to Council Bluffs to help build the cheerleading program at Iowa Western Community College. During his time with the Reavers, Snow helped bring a world championship back to Council Bluffs and helped build an extremely competitive program. Snow oversees many programs through the 712 initiative, but one that is very close to his heart is one that brings out his athletic background. With things across the country being shutting down in March during the start of the pandemic, including the 712 initiative's annual Shamrock Shuffle, Snow wanted to get people out of the house to be active while also maintaining social distancing. This was the start of 5K Friday Fitness at a Distance, a Facebook group hosted by the 712 initiative that invites people to not only get out and run, but also provide positive encouragement to fellow runners lacing up and hitting the trails every Friday. He said he assembled a core group of Council Bluffs runners to get the hashtag 5K Friday in the Facebook group trending, and his modest group of about 20 has since grown to nearly 1,000 members. He said that lately, the pages see more than 200 participants each week, with runners checking in from 25 to 30 states. People often share screenshots of their fitness apps, showing their paces, times, and routes. Snow said every post is met with encouragement from fellow members, and he hopes that the positivity inclusivity inspires more people to get active. We've seen so many cool stories come out of this, he said. This has gotten several people who have never even done this before get out there. And knowing that it's helping people be active and helping them live a healthier lifestyle, it's just great to see. Harlan man found in possession of drugs, explosives, sentenced to 5 years in prison. A Harlan man found with drugs and materials for making explosive devices has been sentenced to 5 years in federal prison. Blake Edward Cooper, age 51, will serve 60 months in prison after pleading guilty to being a drug user in possession of a firearm, according to a release from United States Attorney Mark Crickbaum of the Southern District of Iowa. Cooper was ordered to serve 3 years of supervised release following his prison term and pay $100 to the Crime Victims Fund. Cooper made threats to kill law enforcement officers and innocent civilians on July 29, 2019, according to the release. Law enforcement was alerted to Cooper's possible possession of explosive materials when someone he knew told the Shelby County Sheriff's Office that Cooper had sent a text message in which he complained about the family law system and wrote that collateral damage is needed, resulting in death and injury to police officers and civilians. The text message read, "They're going to come for me, I bet this week. Collateral damage is key to whether or not people get informed as to how rigged the whole family law system is. It's sad to say, but I need as much collateral damage as possible. If a cop gets shot in the leg while serving a warrant, that's local news. If six cops get killed, four wounded, and several innocent civilians get killed or severely wounded, then it becomes national news. And that's the only way anything is ever going to get stuff changed. And now that my whole plan had to be revealed to you, you will be an accessory. 4 days prior to sending the messages, Cooper sent an order confirmation email showing that he purchased 50 pounds of ammonium nitrate. And when law enforcement executed a search warrant in his Harlan residence, they found that and more. 21 firearms, ammunition, and materials that could be used to make an explosive device. Meth and drug paraphernalia was also found. UNO and UNMC will lay off 9 employees and let other positions go unfilled. A total of 9 people have learned they will be laid off this year at the University of Nebraska in Omaha and the University of Nebraska Medical Center, the institution's leader said Wednesday. Dr. Jeffrey Gold, chancellor of UNO and UNMC, said in a Zoom discussion with the UNO community that 63 jobs there will be affected by budget cuts. But about a quarter of those are vacancies that will go unfilled, and well over half of them are employees who will simply be paid from a different source of money, such as federal grant money, than before. Doug Ewald, Vice Chancellor for Business, Finance, and Business Development at UNO and UNMC, said after the Zoom session that 6 will be cut at UNO and 3 at UNMC. All have been notified, he said. The NU system, including schools in Lincoln and Kearney, is working on a $43 million cut over the next 3 years, about $6.3 million of which will be absorbed by UNO. UNMC faces $6.6 million in cuts. The trims are largely related to the coronavirus pandemic's negative impact on the NU system and higher education in general. Masks will be expected to be worn at UNO and UNMC, Ewald said, a point that Gold pounded home at the beginning of his remarks to UNO. Wear a mask, Gold said. Wear a mask. Gold spoke for about an hour Gold spoke for about an hour about the UNO situation Wednesday afternoon after holding a similar discussion with the UNMC community in the morning. The $43 million will be attained by the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's trimming 5.5% of its budget, UNO and the University of Nebraska at Kearney 3.9%, and UNMC 2.9%. Gold said UNO and UNMC plan for several scenarios, including 10% cuts. Ewald told the afternoon virtual town hall meeting that the universities are in a far better place now than we were when 10% slashes were considered. The coronavirus has proven so unpredictable, though, that Gold said projections could be faulty. He said UNO's fall planning includes preparations for nearly normal campus activity and, on the other end, classes provided completely online as took place in the spring. There are two words that I've stricken from my vocabulary, always and never, Gold said of dealing with the pandemic. As of this week, enrollment projections indicate UNO expects strong undergraduate and graduate student enrollment. The numbers who have signed up are greater than at this same time last year. Signing a contract doesn't guarantee that a student will show up, though. Last fall, UNO enrolled about 15,150 students. Ewald said at UNMC, a total of about 4,000 students are expected this fall, which would make it a fairly typical enrollment. Last year, UNMC enrolled 4,055, a record for the institution. Gold assured UNO that the administration is ready to take on the challenges of fall. He said, I can predict that we're going to be as prepared as we can possibly be. The coronavirus and a broken arm lead to reunion between long-lost sisters. It was instant love. As they held hands at Methodist Fremont Health this week, that's how Doris Crippen described her feelings when she learned that the medication assistant at her rehabilitation facility was a sister she had been searching for years. Crippen, age 73, had last seen and held Bev Borrell 53 years ago when she was just a few months old. It's really amazing, Crippen said. It's very overwhelming after so many years. The sisters, part of a group of 10 siblings, were separated by the state more than half a century ago. They knew about each other, but their father married 3 times, and the kids eventually spread out as far as Arizona, and for both, hope grew dim that they would ever find everyone. Then Borrow spotted a name she recognized during her shift at Dunklaw Gardens, which is attached to the hospital. Crippen had tested positive for COVID-19 in early May and was hospitalized. She has recovered, but was being treated for a broken arm, the result of a fall while she was ill. And I thought, gosh, I know that name. And then it hit me, Borrow said. I think that's my sister. Boro decided to visit Crippen's room during her shift that night. Her heart was racing, but there wasn't a shadow of a doubt in her mind. It was indeed her sister. Crippen is deaf, so Boro wrote out the name of their father on a dry erase board and held it up for Crippen to see. She replied, "That's my daddy." Boro then mimicked rocking a baby. Crippen said she looked at Boro and then studied her some more. "She looks a lot like my real dad," she said. "I got the big eyes, but I don't have the brown eyes like him." Boro was excited to tell her oldest sister about some of their other siblings and lots of nieces and nephews. Between the combined marriages of their father and mothers, there are 16 kids in all. One brother died in February, and Boro hasn't yet been able to find four others. She got teary-eyed just talking about discovering Crippen. They've been catching up whenever Boro has a few spare moments on one of her shifts. Crippen is eager to recover and return to an apartment in Omaha, which she left in early May. The mother of three said they'll have more time to connect then. They're talking about planning a family reunion, too. Crippen couldn't sleep that first night after meeting Boro, who lives in Craig, Nebraska. She wonders if they would have ever found each other if she hadn't gotten the virus or if she hadn't needed rehab because of her broken arm. "It was God's work that did this. It was God's blessing that I was sent here," Crippen said. "We don't have to search anymore. The journey is over." Judge: Show evidence to Des Moines Register reporter arrested at protest. A judge has ruled that prosecutors must turn over body camera footage and other material to a Des Moines Register reporter who was arrested while covering a protest in May. Judge Christopher Kemp on Monday ordered the Polk County Attorney's Office to give body cam footage and reports to reporter Andrea Sahuri by the next court date, according to the Des Moines Register. The court date hasn't been scheduled. Sahuri, age 24, was arrested on May 31st while covering a protest near Des Moines shopping mall, less than a week after the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. The black man died after a white police officer used his knee to pin down Floyd's neck, sparking protests across the country. At the protest near Merle Mall, police began shooting pepper spray and ordering protesters to disperse after some people began damaging property and stealing from stores. Although Sahuri said she identified herself as a reporter, she and her boyfriend, Spencer Robnett, were charged with interference with official acts and failure to disperse. They have pleaded not guilty. Robnett accompanied Sahuri to the protest because he was concerned for her safety. Assistant Polk County Attorney Brad Kincaid had argued authorities didn't need to give evidence to Sahuri and Robnett because they were charged with misdemeanors, and such cases were supposed to be handled quickly with little expense. Although the judge said prosecutors must turn over evidence, he declined to dismiss the charges. And now in our Do Just One Thing article. According to This Old House magazine, charcoal from the backyard grill can have myriad detoxifying uses around the house. When arranging flowers, place a few briquettes in the bottom of the vase to help keep the water fresh and clean. If you have smelly kitchen cabinets, place a piece in the back of the cabinet so it can absorb both odors and excess moisture to help keep the area smelling fresh. And lay a few pieces on top of a household orchid plant to help it thrive. The flowers love the alkalinity from the charcoal. You are listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for today, Friday, July 24th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Colleen Ann, known as Connie Hannum Bartle, died July 16th, 2020 in Hopkins, Minnesota, surrounded by her family. Connie and her twin sister Barbara were born in Council Bluffs, September 14th, 1925. A proud fourth-generation resident of Council Bluffs, she was married for 60 years to George Arthur, known as Art Bartle, who died in 2010. She was also preceded in death by her sisters Barbara, Patricia, and brother Donald. She graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1943 and attended Grinnell College. While in high school, Connie participated in the school choir and theater productions. Connie and Art raised three sons, Tom and Mark of Minneapolis and Matt of Salt Lake City, Utah. Connie and Art eagerly adopted the boys' wives, Kristen, Sandra, and Rose, as the daughters they never had, and doted on their seven grandchildren. Connie also lived long enough to meet two great-grandchildren. Connie and Art were active citizens of Council Bluffs. Connie was a member of PEO, an expert bridge player, and a recreational golfer, a dedicated supporter of the Council Bluffs Library and Mercy Hospital, and a devoted student and advocate of Council Bluffs history. She was instrumental in the preservation of Kern Field and was an active supporter of the Dodge House. She was always proud of her Irish heritage and had done extensive genealogical research that reached back more than 200 years. She was a longtime member of the St. Patrick's Church, where a service will be held at a later date. Any memorials are preferred to the Council Bluffs Public Library or the Micah House. Carl F. Ulmer, age 84, of Council Bluffs, passed away July 21st at CHI Mercy Hospital. Carl was born February 10th, 1936, to the late Glenn F. and Ludi Ulmer. He proudly served his country in the U.S. Air Force from 1954 to 1975, two tours in Vietnam. Carl married Ann Pavich on June 28, 1958. They were blessed with four children. After his honorable discharge from the military, Carl worked for the United States Postal Service for 18 years, retiring in 2002. Carl was a member of Corpus Christi Holy Family Parish. In addition to his parents, Carl was preceded in death by his wife, Ann Ulmer, in 2003, and his brother, Robert Ulmer. Carl is survived by his children, Carol Edmondson of Pacific Junction, Iowa, Marilyn Wilson, Michael Ulmer, all of Council Bluffs, Robert Ulmer of Omaha, five grandchildren, Kristen, Lindsay, Lauren, Courtney, and Ryan, two great-grandchildren, Eric and Evelyn, sister-in-law, Pam Ulmer of Zephyrhills, Florida. Memorial Mass will be Saturday at 10 a.m. at Corpus Christi Holy Family Church, interment in St. Joseph Cemetery with military rites tendered by the Canesville Honor Guard. A lunch will follow at the Holy Family Parish Hall. Visitation with the family 1 hour prior to the Mass at the church. The family will direct memorials. Cleo M. Vuagnaux, I'm not sure if I said that right, it's spelled V-U-A-G-N-I-A-U-X, age 93 of Omaha, Nebraska, passed away July 22, 2020 at CHI Bergen Mercy Hospital. Cleo was born June 1, 1927 in Council Bluffs to the late William A. and Lillian J. Goldsberry. She attended Thomas Jefferson High School. Cleo married Warren L. Vuagnaux on August 4, 1946. They were blessed with four children. Cleo lived in Council Bluffs until 1980, spent 27 years in Minnesota before moving to Omaha. In addition to her parents, Cleo was preceded in death by her husband Warren in 2007, grandson Andrew Krahulik, and six brothers. Cleo was survived by children David Vuagnaux, Deborah Moser, both of Council Bluffs, Dean Vuagnaux, Dan Vuagnaux, all of Omaha, six grandchildren, seven great-grandchildren, her three great-great-grandchildren, sisters Donna Herod, Pat Bigelow, Vanessa Sorrell, and brothers Larry Goldsberry, Gary and Gerald Goldsberry, nieces and nephews. Visitation with the family will be Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Graveside service and burial will be Monday at 11 a.m. in Cedar Lawn Cemetery. Family and friends to meet at the funeral home Monday at 10:30 a.m. for the procession to the cemetery. A luncheon will follow at the Walnut Hill Reception Center at 1350 East Pierce Street. Memorials are suggested to Midlands Humane Society. Katie G. Jacobs, age 96, passed away July 22nd at Risen Sun. Katie was born in Council Bluffs on August 5th, 1923, to the late Fritz and Sophie Jacobs, and attended Abraham Lincoln High School. She loved her farm and kept mowing until the age of 89. She acquired shingles, which began her battle. She fought hard and battled the coronavirus, but ultimately her body and soul wore out. Katie was extremely talented in her handiwork of tatting, crocheting, and sewing. She would say, "How can I ever repay you?" We told her that's what family is for, to help one another. Katie was preceded in death by her parents, Fritz and Sophie Jacobs, sisters Martha Jacobs and Margaret Bussey, and husband Walt, uncle Jaime Winkelin and Cody Bergansel. She and sister Martha never married and continued to live on the farm on Gifford Road. She leaves behind her beloved nephew Walt Bussey and family, Sean Wally Bussey, Courtney Lawrence, Ava and Ella Bussey, Emery and Grayson Lorenz, niece Deanna Bergenzel, and family, Chris Hayes, Nathan, Lexus, and Misty Bergenzel, Candy Snipes, Bill Bergenzel, Allie Snipes, Peyton Holtz, and many friends. Many friends and family came to celebrate her 90th birthday, but due to COVID-19, we say goodbye so differently. Open visitation will be Friday from 12 to 5 p.m. at the funeral home. graveside service Saturday, 1 p.m. at Memorial Park Cemetery. Family and friends to meet at the funeral home for cortege to Memorial Park. And now moving back into news articles, Grassley welcomes Trump's resumption of COVID-19 briefings. President Donald Trump's resumption of coronavirus briefings is quite frankly a breath of fresh air, according to Senator Chuck Grassley. The American people just need to be leveled with, the Iowa Republican said Wednesday about the president's Tuesday afternoon briefing on the pandemic. I think he's kind of doing that when he's finally admitting that whether you want to wear a mask or not, I don't want to wear one, but I do, he tells people to wear a mask and that this thing could get worse before it gets better. The briefings, which Trump said would continue on a daily basis, are very healthy for any president, Grassley told reporters. As for Congress acting on a fourth round of pandemic relief, Grassley said members knew 6 weeks ago is likely another round of assistance would be necessary, but wanted to see if efforts to control the spread of COVID-19 were successful and whether the economy was rebounding. There's a whole mess of ideas floating out there, including some of Chuck Grassley's ideas of what Congress should put in the package, he said. One of Grassley's priorities is to include his proposal to limit increases in prescription drug prices to no more than the change in the consumer price index. That would be 2% this year, he said. Action now is important because the price of medicine is both a health issue and a pocketbook issue, Grassley said. As Finance Committee Chairman, Grassley will be involved in discussions about supplemental unemployment benefits, support for rural health care, and tax relief. The supplemental jobless benefits will continue, but not at the current $600 a week, he said. At $600 a week, the federal government is creating unfair competition for small businesses trying to get employees back to work. He's not a big fan of a payroll tax cut because it might be October before it's implemented. If people are get $30 or $40 more in their paychecks, they might not notice it, especially if they are working irregular hours or overtime because of the pandemic. If there's a payroll tax cut, Congress would have to use income tax revenue to replace Social Security payroll taxes, Grassley said. However, if people get a second direct stimulus payment, they're more likely to notice that and spend it, he said. Even if it's something less than $1,200 to the same people again, most of them are probably going to spend it, and if they don't spend it, they are at least going to know they're getting it, he said. Grassley emphasized that it's early days in the discussion. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants to cap the fourth phase relief package at $1 trillion, so you kind of have a zero-sum game because whatever spending is added has to be offset somewhere else in the deal. The U.S. House in May passed an additional $3 trillion stimulus package, which includes aid to state and local governments socked with coronavirus expenses. Trump has said he would veto that measure, preferring the $1 trillion target the Senate is pursuing. Outbreak at pork plant larger than reported. The first confirmed coronavirus outbreak at an Iowa meatpacking plant was far more severe than previously known, with more than twice as many workers becoming infected than the State Department of Public Health told the public, newly released records show. The department announced at the May 5th news conference that 221 employees at the Tyson Foods pork processing plant in Columbus Junction had tested positive for COVID-19. But days earlier, Tyson officials told Iowa Workplace Safety regulators during an inspection that 522 plant employees had been infected to their knowledge, documents obtained through the Open Records Law show. A dozen of the plant's roughly 1,300 workers were believed to have been hospitalized by then, and two died after contracting the virus, Tyson officials told the Iowa Occupational Safety and Health Administration. The discrepancy adds to mounting questions that the state health department faces about its handling of public information during the pandemic. The department last week forced out its longtime spokeswoman, who said she was ousted for pushing hard to fulfill media requests and that the agency's delays and scripted talking points were embarrassing. The agency also has faced criticism for seeking to charge thousands of dollars for open records requests, for not routinely announcing outbreaks in workplaces, among other things. The department said it has gone above and beyond to provide up-to-date and comprehensive information to the public. The early April outbreak in Columbus Junction was the first of several at meatpacking plants across the state as the virus spread through crowded workplaces. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds took a pro-industry approach to managing those outbreaks in Iowa, the top pork-producing state. She worked with executives to continue production even as thousands of workers became infected and some died, and she applauded President Donald Trump's order to keep such plants open throughout the country. On May 5th, Reynolds said at her then-daily news briefing that the Public Health Department had been compiling data from surveillance testing to track outbreaks, which the state defines as at least 10% of employees absent or ill. She turned over the podium to Health Department's Deputy Director, Sarah Reisetter, who said the Tyson plants in Columbus Junction, Perry, in Waterloo, and two other workplaces had confirmed outbreaks. Reisetter said the Waterloo plant had 444 positive cases, but county officials said days later it actually had been more than 1,000. As for Columbus Junction, department spokeswoman Amy McCoy said the 221 case figure announced by Reisetter reflected the results of the department's testing and what it could verify from our data systems at the time. Keep in mind, we had just established an outbreak definition and wanted to share the information we had available, she said. Since that initial round of testing back in April, the testing reporting process has significantly improved. The department never updated the number of confirmed infections in Columbus Junction. Unlike outbreaks at long-term care facilities, the department does not post workplace outbreaks on the state's coronavirus website. At the May 5th briefing, Reisetter said that the 221 cases reflected 26% of those tested, which would be 850 total tests. Tyson spokesman Gary Mickelson said the number of infections announced by the state appeared to reflect only the first round of testing at the plant, and that additional testing had uncovered hundreds of more cases. Coordinating facility-wide testing and obtaining results is a complex process that takes time, he said. But it's unclear why the department would not have the full testing results that Tyson described to Iowa OSHA. The department, along with the county health officials, had conducted the mass testing of workers weeks earlier. Tyson officials said they learned of the first case in Columbus Junction on April 1st and idled the plant 4 days later after 29 workers tested positive, according to the Iowa OSHA inspection report. The governor sent 1,100 testing kits to the county for testing during the two-week shutdown. The plant reopened on April 20th with new safety measures, and Mickelson said their company isn't aware of any current infections there. Iowa OSHA opened an inquiry after seeing media reports that two workers had died from the virus and inspected the plant on April 30th, walking through a meeting with several Tyson officials. There were 522 positive COVID-19 cases to the best of the company's knowledge, the inspection report said. Tyson's plant manager told inspectors that communication between the company and public health officials was not efficient, and that information about the positive cases wasn't available for days after testing, the report said. Iowa OSHA did not cite Tyson for any workplace safety violations, saying the company was trying to follow the best CDC guidelines at the given time, and recommendations were rapidly changing. Movie theaters to studios, release the blockbusters. A long time ago, in a pre-COVID universe far, far away, blockbusters opened around the globe simultaneously, or nearly so. In 1975, Jaws set the blueprint. Concentrate marketing. Open wide. Pack them in. Since then, Hollywood has turned opening weekends into an all-out assault. Staggered rollouts still happen, of course, but the biggest films are dropped like carpet bombs. Anything less risks losing the attention of moviegoers. Global debuts north of $300 million became commonplace. Last year, Avengers Endgame made well north of $1 billion in a couple days. Hollywood has now gone more than 4 months without a major theatrical release. While some films have found new streaming homes, the biggest upcoming ones, Tenet, Mulan, A Quiet Place 2 Part 2, remain idled like jumbo jets on the tarmac. The leading chains are still shuttered. Recent coronavirus spikes have forced release dates to shuffle and chains to postpone reopening to August. Now, movie houses say that despite far from ideal circumstances, it's time for new movies. 4 months of nearly zero revenue has brought the $50 billion annual business to its knees. While the beleaguered restaurant industry still has takeout and airlines continue to operate with massed flyers, the vast majority of U.S. movie theaters haven't punched a single ticket since March. Some have turned to selling popcorn curbside. The problem is, we need their movies, said John Fithian, president and chief executive of National Association of Theater Owners. Distributors who want to play movies theatrically, they can't wait until 100% markets are allowed open, because that's not going to happen until there's a vaccine widely available in the world. The old distribution models of big blockbusters, adds Fithian, needs to be rethought. That may mean returning to a more old-fashioned release pattern, opening films overseas first, and in the U.S., opening at different times and in different areas. When Warner Brothers earlier this week announced it was delaying the release of Christopher Nolan's Tenet because of the rise of cases, Warner Brothers Pictures Group chairman Toby Emmerich said the studio is not treating Tenet like a traditional global day and date release. The coronavirus crisis has ushered in a new chapter in the often symbiotic, occasionally quarrelsome relationship between distributors and exhibitors. Splitting ticket sale revenue approximately in half, their fortunes have often been closely linked. The largest studios, the Walt Disney Company, Warner Brothers, and Universal, now all have streaming services of their own now, along with television operations. So they have options. The on-demand release of Trolls caused a rift between Universal and AMC. But the two halves of theatrical moviegoing have worked largely in concert through the pandemic thus far. It's in their own self-interest. Studios have been loath to sacrifice billions in box office for their priciest and most popular releases. On Thursday, John Stankey, chief executive of Warner Brothers' parent company AT&T, said direct release to HBO Max could be an option for some Warner Brothers movies, but not the $200 million Tenet. With distancing protocols and other measures, cinemas have reopened in parts of Europe, the Middle East, and South Korea, where last weekend, Yoon Sang-ho's Train to Busan action sequel, Peninsula, debuted with $13.2 million. Theaters in China, the world's second-largest movie market, this week reopened with theaters limited to 30% capacity. North America, usually the main event of a blockbuster release, may have to learn to follow the rest of the world. Despite the virus surge in much of the U.S., exhibitors believe they can operate relatively safely by adhering to health officials, decreasing theater capacity, and cleaning in between showings. After initially flip-flopping, AMC will require patrons to wear masks. AMC, the world's largest circuit, on Thursday delayed its reopening from the end of July to mid to late August, a timing that it said reflects the expected new release dates for Tenet and Disney's Mulan, now slated for August 21st. Some moviegoers naturally don't anticipate going, regardless of what comes out. Jeffrey Shaiman, an epidemiologist at Columbia University, isn't planning to go to the movies this year. "It seems prudent to think that indoors is where the lion's share of transmission takes place," says Shaiman. "You could think, well, it's a movie theater. If you space people out, it's a big room, tall ceilings. If they get the ventilation cranked up, it's actually not the most concentrated environment. It's not like a packed bar with a low ceiling. It's probably not as dangerous as that scenario. But is it more dangerous than sitting home and watching Netflix? Yes, of course it is. But if perfect, maybe all cinemas and studios have for now." Vithian believes 75% of U.S. theaters could be open within days if they had new movies. Those currently open are mainly playing older films. Theaters are closed in California and have yet to reopen in New York despite the state's relative success in combating the virus. That removes the top two cities in ticket sales, Los Angeles and New York. The longer this goes, there will be bankruptcy filings and reorganizations, and there will be people who go out of business, says Vithian, who's currently lobbying for greater congressional support for theaters. But if there are no new movies until there is a vaccine, that's a dire situation for a lot of companies. AMC recently raised $300 million in debt relief to help itself remain solvent. Throughout the industry, some 150,000 workers remain furloughed. Now heading over into sports, St. Albert focused on winning fourth state title in program history. It was only about 2 months ago when there was serious uncertainty about a 2020 high school baseball season happening. Now, St. Albert is 3 wins away from their fourth state title in program history. The first obstacle will be a first-round matchup with perennial power Newman Catholic on Saturday at 10:30 a.m. at Principal Park in Des Moines. Third-seeded Albert, with a record of 21-1, is making its 11th state tourney appearance and second in 3 years. The Falcons are 10-8 all-time at state with titles in 1981, 1996, and 1999. Their opponent, 6-seeded Newman Catholic, with a record of 17-5, is the Class 1A 3-time defending champion and has the most state tourney appearances, 24, of any team in Iowa, along with 8 state titles, 4 runner-up finishes, and a 36-15 all-time record at state. The pedigree of both programs and evenness on paper makes for a compelling first-round chess match, and St. Albert head coach Duncan Patterson likes the mindset of his squad. "I think in 2018 the kids were just happy to get there. I think there's more motivation this time because the kids expected to get here and want to do something," Patterson said. "They're going to play like they always have and get after it, but they expect to win it." Offensively, Falcons junior Cy Patterson is tied for first in the state in batting average with a .632, and is first in RBIs with 42, fourth in on-base percentage with .714, and tied for first with 5 saves as a pitcher. Other big bats for St. Albert are senior Lance Wright with .596, 5 home runs, 28 RBIs, junior Isaac Sherrill with .463, 2 home runs, and 34 RBIs, and junior Eric Mathai with .378. Both lineups have popped, with the Falcons ranking second in 1A in home runs with 12, while Newman Catholic is fourth with 10. The Knights are led by freshman Max Burt, who hit .447 with 5 home runs and 40 RBIs, and senior Sammy Kratz, who hit .400 with 3 home runs and 23 RBIs. As a pitcher, Kratz is 5-0 and 7 starts with 0.46 ERA with 62 strikeouts and is one of 5 Knights pitchers with an ERA under 3.0. Right now, we've got the pitching machine pumping it pretty fast, probably 88 to 90 miles per hour, Patterson said. Normally, during the season, we don't do that. We just let the hitters adjust. Now we're trying to speed them up because we know we're going to face someone who throws hard. St. Albert also has a deep pitching staff, ranking 12th in 1A with 2.18 team ERA, while Newman Catholic ranks 16th with a 2.53 ERA. St. Albert's top four pitchers are junior Eric Mathai, 3-0 with a .95 ERA, senior Lance Wright, 4-0 with a 1.24 ERA, junior Jeff Miller, 5-1 with a 2.12 ERA, and junior Luke Hubbard, 5-0 with a 2.62 ERA. Cy Patterson was primarily used in relief, but could take on a bigger pitching role in the win-or-go-home scenario that is the state tourney. We're probably going to rely on 3 or 4 guys. You try to develop your pitching throughout the season, but you've got to go with your top guys when it comes to it, Patterson said. Because of the ongoing pandemic, this year's seeding was determined via Zoom meeting. Each of the 8 coaches was given time to make the case for their team in a process that lasted about an hour and a half, according to Patterson. For more information on this year's state tourney, visit iah-saa.org. And the first round of state baseball tournament starts today at Principal Park in Des Moines. First up, we have Martinsdale St. Mary's. They're 26-1 versus Kingsley Pearson, who is ranked 8th, at 10:30 a.m. Then we have the 4th-seeded South Winneshiek, who's 25-1, versus Don Bosco, who's 17-1. They'll be playing at 1:30 p.m. Then on Saturday, we have number 3-seed St. Albert, who's 21-1, going up against the number 6-seed Newman Catholic, 17-5, and they'll be playing at 10:30 a.m. And then we have number 2-seed St. Mary's, who is 19-0, versus the number 7 Notre Dame, who is 14-2, at 1:30 p.m. Then semifinals will occur on Thursday, July 30th. There's morning and afternoon games to be determined based on how the first rounds go this weekend. With then the championship game will be on Saturday, August 1st, then at 10:30 a.m. So more to come as we get through this weekend. And that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for today, Friday, July 24th. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. Thanks for listening.
This is Jim Ralston, and I'm with IRIS, Short Take from the Iowa Curiosities. Farmers and their toys, Dyersville, Iowa. The wisdom on bumper stickers is true, and those with the most toys truly do win. Then the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville is a winner many times over, with two floors of more than 30,000 farm toys and exhibits, ranging from row after row of common tractors to combines, harvesters, and haulers, all the way down the extensive agricultural machinery lineup to an anhydrous ammonia tanker. The museum is a shrine and miniature to the heavy equipment Iowa farmers fuss over, endlessly fix, periodically live in during planting or harvesting, and tirelessly operate to bring home the grain or the beans that bring home the bacon. And don't let the word toy fool you. The only thing toy-like about these farm toys is that they are built to 1/16th or 1/32nd scale, and don't have internal combustion engines. This is Iowa, after all. Farm machines aren't child's play, even when they're toys. Most of the toys are stunningly accurate, not to mention beautiful. Replicas of tractors or combines with particular makers like John Deere and Case, from particular years, with details accurate down to the windshield wipers. Children play with these toys not only to have fun, they got a vocational education in heavy equipment. Highlights of the museum include an exhibit explaining the notion of scale that features a full-size replica of a John Deere tractor accompanied by a row of successfully smaller scale models, from 1/2 scale all the way down to a realistically looking tractor you can carry in your pocket. Upstairs, look for more tractors and harvesters, enclosed in glass cases, more perhaps than you've ever hoped to see. And though the word toy does technically appear in this museum's name, don't expect much playing around. Tractors, trucks, trailers, and combines, even at 1/32nd or 1/64 scale, are way too wrapped up in Iowa's blood, sweat, and sorrow to be simple objects of play. Don't be surprised if you see some old-timer kicking the tires of a tiny Case combine, wondering how it would hold up harvesting more than 2,000 acres. Or some young, unquietly cussing pocket-sized John Deere because it won't turn over. The National Farm Toy Museum is at the intersection of US 20 and Iowa Highway 136 in Dyersville. Open daily from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., the museum also hosts a number of special events. Exhibits throughout the year, the largest of which is the granddaddy of all farm toy shows, held the first full weekend in November. For more information, call 563-875-2727 or visit www.nationalfarmtoymuseum.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.